From Los Angeles, California, this is the Writer's Strike Chronicles, and I'm Tanya Barnes.
I have a dream. I have a dream. Now is the time. Now is the time.
Hello, everybody. Today is Monday, January 21st, 2008. Day 78 of the Writer's Strike. In today's episode, we speak to screenwriter Monique Matthews at the picket line in front of Fox Studios. Also, later in the show, in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, this episode will also feature a mashup, Martin Luther King versus the Radio, by Davey D from his podcast, Breakdown FM. Before we begin, I just want to share a couple of emails I received today from some of my listeners. The first one is from Egan from NeverEverRecords.com, who writes, I've listened to every podcast and you are doing an amazing job. I am not a writer, although an aspiring songwriter and indie label owner. I really appreciate what you're doing for this cause and future ramifications of said cause. You have a very entertaining way about you that really resonates with me and the writers you interview. I drive past and honk when I'm in the area. Anyway, I was inspired to email you and give you these kudos. I realize that you are working extremely hard, recording the best coverage of this event, which will be written up in the history books. Full steam ahead. Cheers, Egan Never Ever. Well, I don't know about it'll be written up on the history books, but I definitely think it'll be in, you know, internet archives in perpetuity. And thanks so much, Egan. Your words of support really, really helped keep me going. I also received a letter from a Ms. Susan Olson, who is a moderator at the Law and Order Live Journal community of WGA supporters, who wrote in to say, Hi, Tanya. As one blogger to another, just thought I'd send you an email saying that I think your blog and your podcasts are really good, and I hope you keep up the good work. I found especially insightful your Diversity Day podcast. I think as a woman of color, you got some really interesting perspectives from WGA members of color. And by the way, I'm female and white. Susan goes on to say, if you like, I'll do what I can to help you get your readership up and your podcast more listened to, especially by the fans and viewers of the Live Journal community. And then finally, Susan goes on to say that in the next few days, she's going up to Capitol Hill to listen to a presentation that the Colbert Report and Daily Show writers are giving to various congresspersons, which, wow, that sounds really, really, really cool. So Susan, how about this? When you get back, can you post me a message and give us a report of what it was like? The number is 310-439-8754, and that number works for anybody who would like to call in and leave feedback for the show. And Susan, I would absolutely love to get exposure to the LJ community. I actually do have an old account over there, and I'll need to find the password for that. But until I do, your best bet is to point folks to my website directly, which is www.strikechronicles.com. So thanks in advance. I really appreciate that. Okay, so let's move on with today's episode. Here, Bill and I talk with Monique Matthews at the picket lines at Fox Studios. Let's listen.
To come out and to see other writers who are just kind of keeping the faith, it helps you go on.
Yeah, okay. Hi, I'm on the picket lines with...
Okay, Monique Matthews.
Monique, what have you written for?
I've written features, so I've written for various studios, including Paramount Pictures, Disney, and MGM Studios.
What got you in the Guild?
Oh, I had a spec that went out, and my first script was actually for Disney. It was an urban... Mary Poppins, starring Lisa Bonet.
Oh, wow.
It's still in development hell, but yeah.
Right on. Well,
Is she still attached to it?
She is. Gosh, it's been so long ago. I mean, you know, you just learn to take things for what they bring. So exactly. It wasn't May, but I made Daily Variety 10 writers to watch, and my career really, I got other assignments from that, so that was pretty good.
Right, right, right. So it's been all features for you, or have you had any...
It's been all features. I've written some pilots, but I'm primarily a feature writer.
Okay.
So have you been on the picket lines every day?
As a feature writer and understanding the writer's strike, I have another job. I'm also a college professor. I teach English at Santa Monica College.
And, oh, do you?
Yeah, and okay. At Cal State LA. So I come over as soon as I finish with my students.
That's awesome. So
thank you.
Is the strike affecting your budget?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I teach the supplement income. It's not in place of income. Okay. So it's the supplement income.
Right.
Okay.
Which came first, actually, your teaching or the feature writing?
It's actually, okay, one of the things I love about teaching is as a feature writer, it really helps with audience because I work with like 17 to 25-year-olds, and that's like the core demographic, the 18 to 24 market. So I've actually done both. Like, I've been a feature writer. I was at school at UCLA. I've taught. So it's kind of like, you know, just kind of figuring out what you love doing and doing both of them at the same time.
Well, one of the things that's always fascinated me about different creative people is how some of them are served by their quote-unquote day gig, and others it takes away from what they're doing. And it seems, there seems to be no rhyme or reason about that. It just totally depends on the individual. And often, of course, it's no choice, but there you go.
Well, I find it's a combination. Like, when I first started writing as a feature writer, I couldn't do anything else. So even though I had, you know, advanced degrees where I could have possibly taught at the university level, I was just like, okay, I have to get this down. I have to make my mark. I have to write. And I couldn't do anything besides writing. But after you get into the hang of it and for a format, I found that I can actually do both. And it actually serves me. I like audience. I like people. So
since we can't see you, I'll tell everybody that you're a very young-looking person. So this would be...
Thank you. Young-looking in Hollywood. That's a good thing.
That's true. So I take it that this is the first strike you've been involved with.
Yes. I was not available in 88.
But have you been involved with other strikes, with other affiliations of yours? Or?
Just my parents. My mom works in New York City, and they had this big 1199 union strike growing up.
Is that where you're from?
Yeah, I'm from Harlem, from New York City.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What's the 1199 strike? What's that?
That was, gosh, it was about 15 years ago. And they were striking for better benefits, you know, general things that people strike for. And it was all the hospital employees who went out. And I don't remember much except that they were on strike and the toll that it took. And now I'm in a similar position. So yeah. It's really interesting because you don't necessarily think blue-collar work when, you know, when you're a writer in Hollywood. But it's really about, I guess, articulating the needs of the everyday person. So you do have to do everyday things.
Yeah, and as you point out, those are ostensibly two very different worlds. But having been involved with both strikes or both walks of life, do you see more similarities than you would have imagined, or is it just night and day?
Well, I think we're moving to a place where I'm sure you can agree where there's a whole bust up of unions altogether. So
yeah.
I don't necessarily think it's just the big bad studios, conglomerates hate writers. I think it's a move overall. I don't think you can discount what's happening at Walmart and their failure to unionize and then what's happening here. So I think we're just a really large example of that very public struggle. And collectively, the median incomes might be higher than, say, for a hospital employee, but to want to protect people's rights and for people to have a quality of life and to be respected for what they do, I think that's pretty similar.
Right, that's right. Now, people don't know this, but when a cement mixer rolls its cement around, it's actually being supportive.
It does. I mean, it's really interesting. Have you guys been out here all the time?
Oh, yeah.
Because you love the honks and the cement rollers. Those little things are, you know, everyone kind of being in solidarity. Stuff you would never notice in L.A., but you kind of start paying attention now.
So your mom was a hospital worker?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's her take on the strike?
Well, I talk to her about it every day. I mean, she... You know, it's the bastards, but we're keeping her daughter from working.
Was she supportive of you coming out here and pursuing a career in Hollywood, or both?
Well, I went to UCLA and I graduated and never went back. So, I mean, largely, and I mean, as an African American, it's not just like my mom; it's my extended family. Like, family is really big in community.
Right.
And so, my mom was a hospital worker. My grandmother is a retired teacher. My dad is a retired correction officer. So, I come from like a really strong blue collar background.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just kind of really understand fighting and working for things. None of them really wanted me to come out of here because I'm the only child and it's 3,000 miles away from home. But they definitely support me.
Well, especially now that you're making good out here.
Well, as good as you can make as a writer, I think it's one of those prolonged battles. It's always a marathon in writing. So
sure.
It's never like hit rich. But I like it, you know.
Do you feel like, we've obviously been in this now for weeks and weeks. Do you feel like it's going forward, or do you feel like it's no end in sight, or?
I don't know.
Middle,
I mean, I find that when things look darkest, there's generally a break. So, I know what it looks like. It looks like hell. It just looks like, you know, it's been, what, 35, 36 days, and the studios haven't come back to the table, and I, you know, thought we were going to get some traction with the Golden Globes and the other awards shows coming up, so... I mean, I don't know. I'm not one of those people who just looks at doom and gloom. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in Hollywood and be a screenwriter because you can't look at the odds.
Can we talk a little bit about your students? So you use them as an incubator?
Actually, more than as an incubator, kind of gauge what they're interested in, what they're excited about. I might run story ideas past them. But I find that a lot of times people, executives, think they know audience and they have no clue to what audience is. And I kind of let my students talk without asking them and just kind of picking up on what they're interested in and say, oh, why do you like that? What can be more interesting to you? So it was really interesting today. We were working and I have, in Santa Monica, it's like, you know, one of the highest, it is the highest transfer rates to UC and Cal States. And so I have a high percentage of students who commute all the way from South Central or from Compton. I mean, over an hour and a half because they think Santa Monica will give them this better life. So they commute this far. And I had this one Latino student who was talking about how she left Selena, right? Uh-huh. So I was linking Selena to the larger, like, Princess Diana, Aaliyah, the R&B singer, and and people who, you know, died before their time, people who have a deep affinity for. It was really amazing. These are all 17, 18-year-old. And one, everyone knew who Selena was, because I'm sure of the movie, and Jennifer Lopez helped. But she, the girl who was writing about Selena, had no idea who Aaliyah was. And it was just this huge divide.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it, because it was like, and so the students were talking about it, and, you know, that was an example of, wow, you think that's everywhere. And then youth culture just kind of transmits, and it doesn't always do that.
It's ephemeral. Yeah.
Exactly.
Do you talk with them about the strike?
Have a different groups of students, so I've talked to my students in the past about the strike. I've offered them extra credit for coming out and talking about what it's like to be on the strike line as a supporter.
Have they come out?
I have students who've come out to different rallies. Like, there was a rally with the Alicia Keys, and you know, the big stuff you can get them to come out to, but
haven't
been as successful as daily getting them to walk the line.
What about new media? Talking to them about new media?
I talk to them about new media all the time because I just think that...
They probably have things to tell you about it.
They do like the MySpace things, but last semester I was at Cal State LA and there was a copycat shooting in Scandinavia or Finland or in one of those countries that really kind of resemble Columbine.
Yeah.
And there had been no violence in that region before, and then they found out like a week or two prior to that, the United States had arrested these two kids, I think in Philadelphia or someplace in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And they found that through the internet that those kids were in contact with the Scandinavian kids. And so I was just talking to them about new media and how it's like an instant global connection. So that was the link. They were, you know, they're mostly talking about MySpace and things like that. But I just thought, wow, that's pretty powerful.
Can you comment on a digital divide?
What do you mean specifically?
Well, that some people have access to the internet and some don't.
You know, it's kind of like illiteracy. It's like we just have to find a way for everyone to have it. I mean, this is the way the world is moving. And if you can't read, you can't do anything. And I just feel like if you're not on the internet, you can't do anything in a society as well, because
you can't participate in a democracy.
Yeah, you can't do it. Yeah. Yeah, you can't participate in democracy, to quote you.
Since you're primarily a feature writer, I mean, for those of us on the outside, I mean, how is that trajectory, is that affected differently than somebody who writes for television? I mean,
yeah, well, definitely. You'll see it on the line, because TV writers, they're 8 to 12 hours in one particular location.
Yeah.
With feature writers, by the very nature of it, it's a very solitary experience. You go in for meetings, then you go away for about 3 months, so 2 to 3 months to write your project, and then you come back in for meetings, or you communicate through video conferences or teleconferences, and you're discussing notes, but you don't necessarily have to be in a physical location. And that's very different from TV writers. So when the strike first happened, actually, you know, you see TV shows and TV writers all at the same place, and feature writers would, you know, be like, oh, I do features, and it would be pretty sparse. So, and then you had to learn to talk to people who weren't in tele, because, you know, you start, when you first meet people, I think people generally migrate to what they're comfortable and what they know. So the TV writers would really stick together, and feature writers would be singularly walking by themselves, and there's been some, you know, I guess...
I've actually heard that at Diversity Day, in terms of people getting work, that people stick with what they know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
I think it's true. I mean, I think it's a human condition. You have to kind of go outside of that in anything to be successful, but that's what people do.
So is this writer strike, is this your fight as well?
Of course it's my fight. I mean, I need to eat, I need to get paid, and I want my projects to make it to the screen. Even though it's not television, it still very much affects me.
Have you thought about creating content for new media?
I love new media. Yeah, I actually have. There's several things that I love about new media.
I'll talk about that, please.
I love audience, and it's similar to why I teach at the college level. It's like it gives you direct access to talk to people. And I think about like literature, and when you think about some of the great writers of the 20th century and how they used to write in like newspaper columns, and they get these great novels out of just writing, and writers saying, I like this about the character, I don't like that about the character. And they say, oh, okay, I can change it. And so often when we do movies, it's like you do the 2 hours, and then it's like, oh, there's a whole year when nobody wants to see that genre anymore. And what I like about podcasting and new media is that you give a person an 8 to 12 minute bite, and they'll say, this is good, this isn't good. And you can use that for like a larger series, or you can use that for a larger idea for film, but you get immediate interaction from the audience.
Yeah.
It's not delayed. You don't spend $150 million on it to say, oof, we were wrong at that one, you know?
Do you think, I mean, one aspect of that, though, is that it's, I mean, the information is so easy to access, and then it's so easy to dispense with. I mean, do you think that that colors people's opinions as they're sort of yay or naying it? I mean,
you're saying it's so disposable, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it can be. I just think that, are you talking about in terms of people not valuing it, or
no? In terms of
people,
I mean, it's so easy to instantly decide whether you're, you know, whether you like something or you don't. That I sometimes wonder if that actually colors the viewing experience of it.
It can, but I think it's like before I became a feature film writer, I wrote magazines. So
okay,
magazines they really teach you about audience, and I did 50 word, 100. 75 words, 5,000 word pieces, and you learn audience. And if you can't grab somebody in the first 2 minutes, they're not going to tune in. So I just think that it shouldn't be that unfair, but we live in a microwave society. I mean, we're post-MTV. I mean, it's even quicker nowadays. So I just think that you have to meet the audience where they are, and they'll let you know. I mean, if it just has to be interesting. You don't have to like hit them over the head, but if you intrigue them, they'll stay.
Mm-hmm. We've talked to a bunch of people about the different kinds of writers that they've met while out here that they wouldn't normally meet, and it sounds like, you know, for you meeting
almost... Oh, my God. Last week, Ray Bradbury was out here. That was the coolest. Yes. I was on a picket line with Ray Bradbury. Yes. They were wheeling him in his wheelchair.
Oh, no shit.
That was really cool.
Wow. Did you talk to him?
Hi, Mr. Bradbury. Thanks for coming out. I mean, you know, total geek, but you know what he'd say.
Well, we have to talk to him the next time he's out here as well.
Yeah.
No, but so okay, so you met Ray Bradbury, but you met a lot of different kinds of writers out here. I mean, has that, you know, by meeting the different kinds of writers that you wouldn't normally meet, has that broadened your perspective on the whole craft of it, if you will? Or?
Yeah, you know what it does? It makes you realize that they all say the same thing. Keep writing. A writer writes. So you just have to keep doing it. There's no...
Okay, well, now you bring up a good point. How are you able to do that in this climate when it's, you know, pencils down? I mean, how is this affecting your creativity, and how are you able to channel it in a way that isn't, you know...
That's excellent. I mean, one of the things, and when I say a writer writes, it's not always just every day a writer writes, but if you write 20 scripts, you don't stop writing. You know, if you have a failure or things aren't immediately received, you don't just say, that's it, I'm not going to write anymore. You just keep writing.
Okay, so if a tree falls in a forest and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a sound? If a writer writes a blog or writes a script and it doesn't get sold or nobody's reading it, are they a writer?
Yeah, because they'll probably die if they didn't communicate it in some type of way, I think.
Which do you think was the more important invention, the internet or the printing press?
Well, we wouldn't have an internet if there wasn't first a printing press.
That's true.
I think everything for its time. I'm just, I don't know. I don't know if it's Zen or whatever. I just think it's one of those approaches where it's, you know.
Before we go, is there anything about the strike that you think people don't understand that you know, any misconceptions you would like to clear up to anybody observing this from the outside?
I think all you have to do is read the Reuters report and, and anytime you have what's called an objective link that's coming from one of the trade papers, it's just ridiculous. Or I just love how unobjective the quotes are. The quote is always like the writer sucks or the writers are keeping us out of a job. Whenever I read, you know, what's happening in the Hollywood trades that are then transferred over to Reuters like it's real news, and it's not.
And on that honky note.
Honky.
Oh, wait, no. That's not what I meant.
No, you meant honking.
Yes.
Honking, you see?
I wasn't even thinking that.
Yes.
Oh, my dear Lord.
Thank you very, very, very much for your time.
All right. Nice to meet you guys again.
I wasn't even thinking.
You said honking.
I said honky.
You did?
And I
didn't. Wasn't thinking.
And I meant like as an adjective of like honk. Oh my God. I can't believe that didn't occur to me as that word was coming out of my mouth.
Well, that's good if it occurred to you later. That means that we're not always seeing things colorfully.
I have a dream.
That was Monique Matthews at the picket line in front of Fox Studios. Coming up is a mashup, Martin Luther King versus the Radio, which was mixed by Davey D, a hip-hop historian, journalist, DJ, and community activist. You can find more of his work on the ODO.com channel, Breakdown FM, where hip-hop and politics meet. In this piece, we'll hear excerpts from this rarely heard speech that Martin Luther King Jr. gave in 1967 in Atlanta to black radio DJs. And here he talks about the importance of radio and how it impacted the civil rights movement. Also in this mix is a short excerpt Minister Farrakhan gave to a similar body of black radio DJs in Atlanta in 1980 at the Jack the Rapper convention. And in another excerpt, you'll hear from Chuck D, the frontman of the hip-hop group Public Enemy, in which hip-hop, radio, and media is discussed with Cynthia McKinney. Also, you'll hear excerpts from H. Rap Brown, including remarks he made in Atlanta in the 1970s about the way media controls entertainers and uses them as political weapons against the community. And finally, the last excerpt features Rosa Clement and her immortal words from the landmark Hot 97 protest in New York from 2005 after the tsunami fiasco, where she talks about corporate media being used as a weapon and how she is determined to fight and not let them harm her child. Here we go.
I have a dream that one day I will ride on in Alabama.
From the dirty, dirty to the hyphy bay, to the Big Apple where hip hop began, we got you covered.
Pump it up loud, feel the bass.
Real hip hop, my man.
Oh, yeah.
Breakdown FM.
What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
Thank you very kindly. Mr. Chairman, members of this very fine organization, the National Association of Radio Announcers, distinguished dais guests, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this evening and to share with you in your annual convention. I valued a special opportunity to address you this evening. For in my years of struggle, both North and South, I have come to appreciate the role which the radio announcer plays in the life of our people. For better or for worse, you are opinion makers in the community. And it is important that you remain aware of the power which is potential in your vocation. The masses are almost totally dependent on radio as their means of relating to the society at large. They do not read newspapers. Television speaks not to their needs, but to upper middle class America. One need only recall the Watts tragedy and the quick adoption of the Burn, Baby Burn slogan to influence of the radio announcer on the community. But while the establishment was quick to blame the tragedy of Watts, most unjustly, on the slogan of Magnificent Montague, it has not been ready to acknowledge all of the positive features which grow out of your contribution to the community. No one knows the importance of Paul White in the massive nonviolent demonstrations of the youth of Birmingham in 1963. The funds raised by Purvis Spann for the Mississippi Summer Project of 1964 are the consistent fundraising and voter education done for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Civil Rights Movement by Georgia Wood, my good friend of Philadelphia. Tonight I want to say thank you, not just to these few, but to all of you who have given leadership to our people in thousands of unknown and unsung ways. We would certainly not have come so far without your support. And in a real sense, you have paved the way for social and political change by creating a powerful cultural bridge between black and white. School integration is much easier now that they share a common music, a common language, and enjoy the same dances. You introduced youth to that music, created the language of soul, and promoted the dance which now sweeps across race, class, and nation. It is quite amazing to me to hear the joyful rhythms which I found time to enjoy as a youth here in Atlanta years ago, coming back across the Atlantic with an English accent, or to see the Senator Javits and the Senator Kennedys lost in the dances which we created. Yes, you have taken the power which old Sam had buried deep in his soul and throughout amazing technology performed a cultural conquest that surpasses even Alexander the Great and the culture of classical Greece. But my brothers and my sisters, we're only beginning. We still have a long, long way to go.
You must address yourself to these problems. These are the problems you live with daily. They don't want your old hard heads. They want the young mind. 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 They want the young mind.
Stop.
MSNBC.com and you see the seven top executives of MS Communication, they are all white men over the age of 50.
Right.
Programming poison to our children. As a new mother with a two-month-old, I refuse to let these companies, these corporations, call my daughter a bitch, a hoe, a nigger. It's over. It's not about free speech. It's about you're peddling drugs into the mind of our community. What you do is addicting our children to violence.
Can you get down? Can you talk trash? Can you get funky? Can you get nasty? You got the job. Now look, brother, that's the basis upon which they hire you. And do you know why? White folks is into the business of mind control.
If you look at BET and MTV owned by the Viacom network, they extended teenage years to 31. And it's nothing more foul than when you see that an older cat is mixing their lifestyle with somebody 12 or 13. Ain't nobody hardly in all these control areas, they don't talk, forget about high schools. You gotta see what's going on in 7th grade, 6th grade, and 5th grade. And I tell 12th graders, 11th graders, don't you got a little brother or sister that think they grown? They say, uh-huh. So there's a problem with trickle down. The older, the 30-year-old is afraid to talk to the 20-year-old. The 20-year-old afraid to talk, oh man, I can't talk, they little wild. The 14-year-olds is wild. The 14-year-old, they ain't even talking to the 10-year-old anymore. And this comes from not owning your word. And this comes from not owning your word.
Entertainers, we dominate the field of entertainment, but we don't control the field of entertainment. And people, entertainers, are used as weapons against us. They are used as political tools against black people. The whole movement is in danger of being co-opted by the politicians of the white power structure. They recognize that if they can get black people thinking culturally, they don't have to worry about them moving politically.
Where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Speaking truth to power in times of turmoil. It's Breakdown FM. Radio, radio, radio. With the meaning.
It's all in power.
You have been listening to the Writer Strike Chronicle podcast, available for free through iTunes. For more information, visit us at www.strikechronicles.com. To contact us, please call 310-439-8754 or send us an email at info@strikechronicles.com.
I have a dream. I have a dream.
betrayed.